This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and our TV show can be seen on Free Speech TV and on our website. Among those that were heading to Washington, D.C. for Donald Trump's inauguration are two workers from Indianapolis, Nancy McCubbin and Julie Meadows, who credit Trump with saving their jobs at the Carrier plant. They told the press, quote, "Trump did a lot for a lot of people at that plant. We were going to be gone. Now there's a lot of us that will be there." End of quote. One of Trump's earliest post-election acts was to announce that he had saved hundreds of jobs at the plant that he had made a focus of during his election campaign. But after the dust settled, the union workers he had pledged to help realized that Trump had inflated the numbers of jobs that would be saved. As the nation ushers in the 45th president of the U.S., we turn to our news correspondent, Arun Gupta, who recently spent time with dozens of Carrier workers in Indiana and told their stories in an article for Raw Story. Economic stagnation of the kind these workers are facing is one that is multiplied across the nation. Arun Gupta is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. He writes regularly at Telesur English, and he is a regular news correspondent for our program. Welcome back to the show, Arun.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So, of course, so much to talk about as Donald Trump is inaugurated, but let's focus on Carrier, because this was the one issue that he sort of rallied a lot of populist support on, that he was going to help workers, and specifically, as an example, the workers at the Carrier plant. Let's clear up first what the inflated numbers issue was before we get into the story. He said he was going to save a certain number of jobs. Turned out it was a smaller number, right?
Yeah, there are kind of a lot of different numbers, because we're actually talking about three plants where Trump said he was going to stop the offshoring. And he went after them on Twitter. First was the Carrier Corporation, which has a facility in Indiana that makes furnaces for the homes. Then there's a Carrier factory in Huntington, Indiana, in the northern part of the state, that makes the control panels, the brains, for heating, ventilation, air conditioning units. And both those Carrier units facilities are subsidiaries of United Technologies. They're a Fortune 50 company, a huge U.S. government contractor with billions of dollars in Pentagon contracts. And then he went after another Indiana company, Rexnord. They make ball bearings, agricultural industrial ball bearings, and they were also going to outsource jobs. And all three of the plants, this was kind of, at least between Rexnord and Carrier, it was coincidental, are shifting to Monterrey, Mexico. So the main plant that we're talking about is the Carrier plant in Indianapolis. And this became an issue about a year ago when Carrier execs got up before the workers and told them the entire plant was being shut down and moved to Monterrey. And someone recorded a cell phone video of it. It went viral. Trump made it an issue during his campaign as a poster child of offshoring. And the number of jobs there that would leave was about 1,350. And then there's another 300 or about 350 jobs that are in administrative and engineering that were never intended to leave.
So tell us what you did. You went and met with workers in Indiana. Specifically, where did you go and who did you meet with?
So I went and met with workers at all three facilities. These are at their union halls. These are all unionized workers. The two plants in Indianapolis are members of the United Steelworkers Local 1999. And the Rexnord facility has 350 union employees in the bargaining unit. And then in Huntington, Indiana, there's 738 union employees. That's at the Carrier plant that makes the brains for the units. And they're in the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 983. So I sat down and I ended up doing lengthy interviews with 17 of them just to get a sense of, you know, where they're coming from, what their thoughts are. Most of the people I talked to, nearly everyone, is losing their job.
So you specifically sought out those workers who were basically the ones who didn't make the cut. And did you find that they were angry with Trump about a broken promise?
Well, here's the thing. So I was looking for workers who were losing their jobs, but when you add everything up between the three plants, so it turns out Trump gets on stage December 1st, a lot of fanfare, big dramatic news conference, you know, he dominated the news cycle for days and says, we're saving 1,100 jobs. We're saving all these jobs. In fact, there's going to be more jobs here. And the president of the Steelworkers Local, Chuck Jones, he told the Washington Post, Trump got up there and lied his ass off. Which he did because the union was told right before Trump went on stage, well, there's only 730 jobs that are being saved in your bargaining unit. There's another 70, like kind of clerical and maintenance workers. And Trump was including those, apparently including those administrative and engineering workers. Now, what pissed off Chuck Jones, and that's what he said, and the other union officials, is he never said a word that at that Carrier plant where he claimed he was saving all those jobs, 550 people are still going to be fired. And, you know, we can call it layoffs, but I think that's semantics. At the end of the day, you're still being booted out of your job. And so Chuck Jones and other union officials, Robert James, the vice president of the union who I sat down with, they had to then go to workers and tell them, actually, that's not true. And the workers, a lot of them were really pissed off. They were like, what the F? You know, he told us that all the jobs are going to be saved. And then they had to go and tell him, no, 550 of you are going to be fired.
So, did you find among these workers that you spoke with, and you write about this, that some of them are still forgive, you know, some of them voted for Trump, some of them are forgiving of Trump, and there was also su support among these workers for Bernie Sanders. How do you help us understand the political leanings of this specific group of workers?
Yeah, I mean, you know, spending the week talking with them, one of the conclusions I came away with is these workers have a very sharp sense of their own self-interest. A lot of them, so of the workers who voted, half of them voted for Trump. These are unionized workers. Half of them voted for Trump. Some of them were enthusiastic supporters of Trump. Not one, a bunch of them in the general election ended up voting for Hillary Clinton. Not one was an enthusiastic supporter of her. They would say things, you know, we're tired of broken promises or she's the lesser evil. I got the impression that the one candidate the workers were really excited about and really thought stood with working people was Bernie Sanders, you know, and they were like, he's been out there for over 20 years, you know, he's the one who really spoke to the issues. And the reason so many of them went for Trump, and this is, I think it's interesting, but I'll explain why it's not surprising at all. Every single one of the workers who said they voted for Trump still support them. Still support Trump. And near as I can, I'm trying to think, I think every single worker who did say they voted for Trump, or let's say virtually everyone, is being fired, yet they still support Trump. And that's because they get it. The Democrats have been terrible. You know, one of the workers, Brian Hunter, he told me from the Rexnord facility, he told me, you know, did Trump save all the jobs? No. Did he save some of them? Yeah. Did he do more than the last president? Yeah. Or John Feltner, the vice president of the Steelworkers local unit at Rexnord, said, you know, yeah, I still support him. You know, others were like, he's not in office yet. You know, we need to give him a chance. But John Feltner, you know, said, you know, with Hillary, we know what we're going to get. With Trump, we don't know what we're going to get. We still don't know what we're going to get. It's a shot in the dark, but at least it's a shot.
And of course,
And
this is a very, very crucial point. The Democrats and the Democratic Party should see this as exactly the point from which they can, gain more political support. Of course, the question is, will they take that point?
well, I mean, you know, they the let's we need to be, I don't think this is should be any big revelation, but I think one of the principles we need to stick to in the era of Trumpism is to be ruthless in all our criticisms. But Obama and the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party see as their base Wall Street. You know, that's who they really look to, and corporate America. You know, corporate America, Hollywood, Silicon Valley. They've essentially united this cultural capital of liberal identity politics with the cognitive and financial capital. The Hillary Clinton campaign was pretty explicit about we don't need these blue-collar white workers, even though they make up one-third of the population. You're going to throw one-third of the population overboard and still think you can win the presidency. Their surrogates went around saying things like, for every white blue-collar worker we lose in the Midwest, we'll pick up two Republican-leaning women in the suburbs. Well, they lost all those blue-collar white workers, and they didn't gain any of those Republican-leaning women. It was an utterly disastrous strategy. And you know, I think we all, you know, I certainly include myself, should have been more critical of this. You know, you're going to throw your base overboard and think you're going to appeal to the opposition for one of the most reviled politicians ever.
Let's stay on the issue of the carrier plants in Indiana and other blue-collar industries like that and jobs like that. I mean, Trump, of course, pulled off yet another media coup through the work that he through the press conference that he held that you referred to, even if in the end the union leaders attempted to reveal what he really did. However, how is he expecting to repeat this kind of action on a mass scale? I mean, even if he saved a few hundred jobs at one set of plants, is it going to require intervention by the US president in individual factories to keep these jobs here?
Well, of course not. There's no way he could do it. I think there are different calculations. He would have to do something on the order of like 20 of these deals a month to add the number of manufacturing jobs that were added from the trough of the Great Recession in 2010 up until the present. You know, Chuck Jones, the steelworkers' local president, I think was absolutely right in saying this is a dog and pony show. Everyone was, you know, said they were very grateful. And just getting back to the last point, I do want one thing, and when I say they have a very, the workers have a very sharp sense of their own self-interest. Time and again, the number one issue was NAFTA. They kept pointing to NAFTA, NAFTA, NAFTA. This is why they're losing jobs. And when they hear these announcements, and Indiana is not unique. It's this, like a lot of the Midwest, Northeast, it's a graveyard of manufacturing. You know, like workers, when they would sit down, they can rattle off all these plants that closed, like, you know, these faded baseball stars of the past. They would be, well, there used to be like Alcoa, RCA, Pratt & Whitney, GM, Ford, Pyle Speakers, you know, on and on. They could name all these different plants that employed hundreds or thousands of people and are now gone. And it's a graveyard of manufacturing. And they understand that a lot of that outflow is because of NAFTA. So when they hear a plant closing, they're like, well, the plant closing is because of NAFTA. NAFTA is because of the Democrats. And Hillary Clinton's was a big supporter, along, obviously, along with her husband, Bill Clinton, of these corporate free trade deals. So this is what really, I think, led to so many union members turning against Hillary Clinton. And they didn't buy her, you know, 11th hour conversion to being against the Trans-Pacific Partnership after she had been for it for so long. So the Democrats really, I think, have done this pretty much all to themselves. You know, certainly Republicans bear huge responsibility for 50 years of racism, race baiting, group hatred for the rise of Trump. But he could not get such traction without the Democrats basically kicking the working class in the face of all colors. That's very important to point out, of all colors, time and again.
I mean, is it fair to say that Hillary Clinton attempted to use the issue of identity politics, which is appealing to people because she was not Trump and identifying as a woman, and the fact that she was basically going to get the standard Democratic voters that the Democratic Party has had a lock on minorities, et cetera, and left out the economic side. On the other hand, Trump did exactly the opposite, focused on the economy, and then spewed a lot of hatred and encouraged a lot of racial animosity. And really, what we need is for leadership to espouse both a very, very strong, a strong adherence to racial and gender justice and economic justice. That is a winning formula for political progressivism and possibly for winning elections nationwide.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there's a way to do this on the left side, on the progressive side. I mean, it's simply what intersectionality is really supposed to be about. Whereas, how does race, gender, sexual orientation intersect with class? You know, the lived experience of class. And when you have globalized capitalism burrowing its way into every niche society ecosystem in the world, the only way to really oppose it is through workers' movements. But we can't act like all workers have the same lived experience of capital. And that's the power of a real intersectional politics. What we get is this bastardized version with the Clintons and the neoliberal version, which is we're going to take identity and graft it onto cognitive capital, onto creative capital, cognitive capital, financialization to basically give it a pretty face. So diversity is about women in the boardroom. Diversity is about, you know, Latino judges handing down harsh sentences. Diversity is about African American generals leading wars. So it's just putting a different face on the same destructive system. And this was
So an
very
emphasis on
much.
symbolism rather than substance.
Yeah. And, you know, let's look at Hillary Clinton herself. I mean, her history, I mean, this just the utterly cynical way she tries to present herself as a feminist or, you know, her turn, like, you know, acting like, oh, people should vote for her just because she's a woman. This woman basically built her political career on impoverishing, jailing, and bombing poor brown women. From serving on the board of Walmart in the early 1980s to gutting social welfare to mass incarceration to just the just heinous acts she committed as Secretary of State, she is consistently one of the most anti-woman politicians in the United States, and yet she tries to own that mantle. It's just utterly reprehensible.
Incidentally, there are some rumors that she may challenge Bill de Blasio for mayor of New York City in the next election. You're a New Yorker.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't pay that much attention as of yet, and I have a bit of a hard time seeing that she would want to settle for a position like that. But you know, whatever. You know, maybe she'll run, and if she runs, she has a good chance of winning, and then she can buddy up with Trump regularly at Trump Towers.
Like
There's
she
two peas in
did,
a
like she
pod.
and Bill did well before their campaign started. Okay, so let's set our sights on Trump because we have 4 years of this. Now, as you and I are talking, it's the day before the inauguration. By the time our audience watches this interview or hears it, it'll likely be after the inauguration and even during or after the Women's March on Washington, D.C. on Saturday, this historic gathering. And interestingly, in examining the platform of the Women's March, really, you know, great starting points on racial justice, gender justice, LGBT rights, et cetera. One small paragraph on workers' rights and their right to organize, but nothing really, no really substantive position that I could see on ending corporatism, on a critique of capitalism. Is that asking for too much? Because of course, perfection can be the enemy of us all. And at the same time, if we don't critique capitalism, neoliberal economic policies, free trade agreements, et cetera, we are just doomed to repeat the same pattern over and over again.
And I think part of that, a big part of that same pattern is just holding these protest marches. Going forward, we can identify various forms of broad forms of political activity. There's protesting, there's mobilization. That's what's going on Saturday. The organizations that recruit, there's electoral politics. There's some who advocate insurrectionism. It's just a pretty self-defeating idea by immature anarchists. But the thing that isn't done that often is genuine organizing. And what genuine organizing involves is being in a broad multi-issue organization that strategically goes out and talks to people who don't agree with you or who are not on your side already. These big marches are all about mobilizing people who already agree with you to go to a protest. That is not how movements are built. Movements are built through on the ground, strategic, democratic daily practice. And so I think this is, the left, progressives, liberals, have to get back to basics, and they have to really start to engage in base building. So yeah, it's great there are going to be all these people out there, but mobilizations really don't have that much of effect. And how many of these mobilizations have we seen over the last 20 years, from, you know, the global justice movement to the Iraq anti-war movement to immigrants' rights organizing to Occupy Wall Street? I think more strategic type of protesting has been Black Lives Matter. Nonetheless, you know, these different forms of political activity, I've all pointed out, serve a crucial purpose, but they have to be, they exist on top of real organizing, not instead of. And that's one of the things the left and liberals have to start to address now. Organized labor does not do a very good job of real organizing anymore.
Right. I mean, they end up giving their support to the Democratic Party with very little in return. And if the movement going forward doesn't have a strong critique of the Democratic Party along with the Republican Party, we're going to basically have the same issues all over again. I mean, it seems like this is a big issue given that so many Hillary Clinton supporters are among those who are going to be marching on Saturday. And unless they and you know, those among us who were Clintonites right from the start, not just after Bernie Sanders lost the nomination, but right from the start, unless they sort of stop and take stock of the reasons why she wasn't able to carry this election outside of stories of Russian interference, et cetera, then we're not going to be able to have that articulation of a future where neither Trump nor Clinton is at the leadership and really workers and women and folks are leading the charge for how we want this country to be. So you, briefly also, in the very immediate aftermath of the election, one of the things that you were saying, Arun, that I remember is that cities, as opposed to rural parts of the United States, can be really important bastions of political organizing. Can you leave this conversation with thoughts on that? How and why cities can become those centers of organizing?
Cities are where Americans live. There's only about 19% of the population that lives in rural areas. 81% are cities, suburbs, exurbs.
And the political power that those rural areas have outweighs the political power that cities have simply because of the way in which our electoral system is set up, right?
Right. I mean, that's the irony that cities, they're the economic engine of the country. They're where most people live. But because of state senates and the U.S. Senate, it gives just and, you know, very various county governments, it disproportionately gives huge power to these low density, underpopulated areas. And so the Democrats have essentially allowed themselves to be surrounded in the cities. We can almost think of it like, you know, this almost classical peasant style warfare. And I think le the left and progressives have a real opportunity here. Don't get overly focused on trying to primary Democrats in 2018 in terms of Congress, because liberals, progressives, and labor just don't have the resources to take on the Wall Street wing of the Democratic Party. Instead, build power within urban areas, within municipal counties. So, you know, those counties that are around these heavily urbanized areas. There's also another strategy that relates to the Democratic Party. And I'll say real quickly, we need to get beyond this. Should we enter the Democratic Party and realign it, or do we build a third party from the ground up? The third party from the ground up has huge impediments that are never going to work because access to third parties is determined at the state level, and state level have these enormous barriers. So if you build political power at the municipal level, you can decide city by city. Maybe we run as independents, as in Portland or Seattle. Maybe we form our own slate, as in Richmond with the Richmond Progressive Alliance. Maybe we run as Democrats, like in Jackson, Mississippi, or Chicago. So you take different strategies, but the goal is to split the Democratic Party, to really make that contradiction between this base that wants social democratic parties as wide as possible with the Wall Street wing and start to break it apart. That's how you build a third party, is from the remnants of an existing party. So it's not so much an inside strategy as break the Democratic Party apart and take the parts that we want.
Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, we will have to have you many times back on this program as we deal with the era of Trump. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Arun Gupta is a correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. He is an investigative journalist who's written for dozens of publications, including The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Nation, and Salon. And he wrote a new article in Raw Story about carrier workers in Indiana. We'll post a link to that article from our website. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.